This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. This episode is brought to you by the Great American Magic Company, purveyors of fine magic. I recommend that you go over and check out their store because they've got a lot of, Gosh, they've got thousands upon thousands of magic supplies over there. So if there's anything that you want seen or heard about, you need to go check it out. See what kind of prices they've got. And also, whenever you do make a purchase, that they have a point system so that as you acquire things that you can get free stuff after you acquire so many points. And they're always having all kinds of sales, flash discounts, special events, etc. So you need to bookmark that on your computer so this way that you can check it out frequently and see what kind of great deals you can have. So go and check out the greatamericanmagiccompany.com. See what kind of deals they've got today. They are great supporters of the Magic Word Podcast, and perhaps you should be too. While at the recent IBM and SAM combined convention here in 2017 in Louisville, Kentucky, there were just a lot of magicians there. In fact, there were, as I understand, about 975 registered and then a lot of walk-ins. So I'm sure they ended up with well over 1,000 attendees at the convention, which included a lot of great magicians who were all registered there who were not necessarily even part of the performers. I got a chance to talk with several of the registrants as well as the organizers and the dealers, and it was just a lot of fun. And, of course, I did daily updates from the convention there that you can go back and listen to in previous episodes here on the Magic Word Podcast. But a couple of people that I spoke with that actually took a little bit longer than just our usual, hey, how you doing? What do you think of the convention type of conversations? We got into a lot deeper things, but it wasn't really long enough to warrant a full podcast. In two different cases, they were both about a half hour in length. When put together, equal the perfect amount of time, which you're going to have here. So that's why I call this a twofer, because you're getting two for the price of one. And for the price of one, gosh, if you're not donating anything, then you're getting them for free. And so what a deal that is. Well, for that matter, everybody's getting this for free because there is no charge for this. However, that if you want to be a friend of the Magic Word and help offset or defray some of our expenses that we have for microphones and for our monthly domain charges for our server, and let alone just the time and effort and work that I put into all this, any and everything will be appreciated. Well, anyhow, more on that later. But for now, again, I wanted just to let you know about the two people that we're talking with here today. One of them was a performer who was on the opening night show. In fact, he opened the convention. He was the first act on the evening show on Wednesday evening, which was day one. Well, according to my podcast, it was day two, because the night before was the Billy Toppett movie that Lance Burton had debuted there in Louisville. So I call that day one. But to be clear, the first day of the convention, quote-unquote, I guess, officially, was when they had the evening show. Well, nevertheless, Jonathan Neal was the person who was opening the show. Now, back in 2015, if you go back in the archives, you can listen to me chat with Jonathan for a little bit there. And we went into some interesting topics, and we did the same thing here again, but a little bit different. Actually, I caught him in the dealer's room, and it was intended, as I mentioned, just to be a brief chat to find out what he was thinking of the convention. Well, he was just going to be there for a short time, so I didn't have a chance later to really sit down and go into more of an in-depth conversation with him. So this chat ended up being kind of an in-depth conversation and ended up being, again, about a half hour. So it was just delightful. I learned a lot. It was one of these things that I want to go back and listen to a few times myself because of some of the good advice. Now, those of you who may not know Jonathan Neal, he's been around for quite a while. In fact, if you go to themagicwordpodcast.com for this episode, you can watch a YouTube video that was taken during his performance on the Johnny Carson Show back in 1984. So he has been around for a while and has been doing some excellent work. And one of the things he talks about since this convention was in Louisville, which was Lance Burton's hometown. He talks about working with Lance at the body shop after he had, right around the time after he had won the FISM Grand Prix, and then was on the Johnny Carson Show and all that. So nevertheless, he talks a little bit about that, and I think you'll enjoy hearing Jonathan talk about that, plus his philosophy. And then the second person that we talk with is
David Bull. Now, you may not know the last name, but you certainly know the first name of Le Grand David and his spectacular magic company. It was part of Marco the Magi, that is Cesario Pelez, that ran for 35 years, starting in 1977 there in Beverly, Massachusetts. That was a fantastic show that ran for so many years, just a grand and glorious show. And so we chat for a little bit about whether that he thinks anything like this can ever be replicated again, plus talks about what some of the cast and crew are doing now, including himself. Well, I'm going to kind of stand out of the way and let you enjoy this. We're going to start off in chronological order because it was on the first day, actually, of the convention that I spoke with Jonathan Neal. And then at the president's farewell party on the final evening, Saturday night, was when I talked with David Bull. So let's begin here with Jonathan Neal here on The Magic Word. All right, Scott Wells for the Magic Word Podcast again. We're still in the dealer's room, and I run into Jonathan Neal Brown. It's good to see you then again.
A pleasure as always.
We spoke together at the Magic Castle a couple of years ago, so you guys who are listening can go back to the website, and you can do a search for his name, because I said it behind his back, and I've said it to his face. You're one of my favorite magicians. I just think
you're too kind.
You are very elegant. You are. I love the music. I like your thinking. I like the everything about you, Jonathan.
Thank you.
If I was a single woman, you know. Okay, I'm not gonna go that far. But
right.
I'm in love with you. I think that
I
have a magician man crush on you. That's one of my favorite magicians. No, I like. So you were here filling in for somebody who couldn't make it.
It was Hiroki Hara.
Okay.
And I guess there was some paperwork issue, you know, with his green card business or whatever. It wasn't up to date or something, so he couldn't get it renewed in enough time.
Okay.
And Dale Solwack called me about a week ago and said,
hey, help us out.
Can you help us out? And I said, what do you need? And he told me what he needed. And so I've put together a program for that.
Okay. Now, is it like a 12-minute or what,
I'm
going to
do, I think, 16. That's as tight as I could compress what I wanted to do.
On the Thursday night.
On the Wednesday.
Wednesday night show.
Right. First act on.
Okay, so first act on. For those people then who are listening to this podcast on Wednesday morning, then you need to get over to Louisville right away in order to see the show.
I would hope.
His. Okay, you're the opening act then.
First act, first show.
Is there going to be all music? You're going to be doing any talking?
I will.
You're going to do your gypsy thread or anything?
I'm going to do that, sure.
It's
a music program with introductions or minor remarks throughout.
Right.
I'm working with my wife, my partner,
mm-hmm.
so we cut it down to about 16 minutes.
And from here you said that you're not going to be able to really spend much time because you're kind of a last-minute fill-in, you got to get and go.
Right.
Are you going back on a cruise, or where are you heading?
Yeah, I have a ship engagement. About a year ago, Dale Solwack and I had talked about doing this, and you know, we didn't lock anything in because my contracts on the ships and so forth and so on. But at the last minute, he gave it to me. But I would have stayed, had I known earlier, I would have stayed for the week and done a lecture.
Yeah.
Because I don't have a lecture for magicians ever in the United States.
Have you thought about doing a tour? You know,
I
set up tours, lecture tours, yeah.
Oh,
I've got like 36 cities, you know, that I work with.
I'm thinking about it. Yeah.
Okay. I mean, I've got next year, I'm going to be working with Brian Gillis in January, and then February I've got Gregory Wilson and some other guys, you know, following.
Yeah.
And so I'd like to do that. I'll give you my card and we can...
Yeah, please, let's do that.
Keep together.
Because
I'm
thinking of getting on to that.
Okay.
I've got a lot of material that I've used over the years, and some of it I'm going to release, make available, and put it into a lecture.
Right.
And
well, I think what you'd have to say would be fascinating, because I think, again, you've got a very creative mind.
Well,
your presentations are different from other people, that you take some classic standards and make...
I twist them.
That's what I like about I love Frank Sinatra. He just takes the standards and puts his own spin on it,
that's
and
it.
Nobody does it like him.
Yeah.
And you
do
and use some Frank Sinatra music. And
I'm selling style.
See, I can't even speak as well as you. You're selling style. That's exactly what you're doing.
There's a lot of guys who can do tricks.
Yeah.
I'm selling style.
Yeah. And so, do you think that's something you could teach?
No.
In a lecture form?
Although that's a second project at some point I want to do about doing a workshop for magicians called, you know, showmanship techniques.
Yeah.
How to increase the entertainment value of your magic, how to stage it better, how to get more out of it, how to create more contrast in a magic act so that you're appealing to different elements. That's something else. But I have a number of these things in mind. One is tricks and material, in other words, ideas I've had.
Right.
And another one is a more interactive workshop kind of thing.
Okay.
You know, probably at a convention or something, or a regional convention, where guys say, hey, you know, this is what I want to need to work on.
Right.
I see so many acts that have the technical skills. They know how to fan the cards. They know how to steal the load. They know how to do that kind of thing that we all learn. But unfortunately, they don't always know how to get from point A to point B on the stage.
Right.
Which means that they're losing the connection with an audience. They're so involved in what's happening in their hands. A lot of them haven't learned to look up and address the audience.
You're watching yourself.
Right.
Yeah.
They're still in that stage. Or they've never had anyone teach them. You know, they don't know how to make an exit without turning their back on an audience. For some reason, that part of it has gotten lost. I kind of know why.
Why is
that?
Because
there's fewer pros working for them to emulate. For those of us who grew up at a certain age where
you don't see Marvin Roy working anymore.
You don't. Yeah. You don't see Ed Sullivan shows where there's a magician on every week. The only time you see now magic on television is one of these competitions, which is cut to 90 seconds, so you don't even see people make an entrance. Quite often the camera flashes, they're doing their thing, and then we get a backstory on their family or something.
Right.
But it's not an act. It's not a complete presentation.
Right.
And so a lot of those skills are lost.
That's a good point. That they don't see that, and so they don't have anybody really as a mentor or anyone to emulate them. You know, I'm thinking, for an example, that there are some classes that you can take of direction where that if you're listening and open to taking direction, that someone will tell you, well, instead of turning around, you know, instead of reaching across your right hand, just reach to the left hand and continue to look at the audience, you know, whatever.
The old timers were very schooled in that, and even if you don't want to take it as strictly as they do, there's an awful lot of those lessons that can be absorbed in a very natural way. Mm-hmm. One of my mentors was Charlie Miller. And Charlie Miller had a number of old school ideas, old staging ideas. You don't cross the center line of your body. If something is on your left, you reach for it, your right, you transfer it to your left. So in other words, you never reach across
yourself. Turn your torso, yes.
Right. Now, in magic, we have technical requirements that don't always allow that to happen.
Okay.
You need to reach with your opposing hand because
you got to do a steal.
You got to do a steal or
ditch,
something.
Yeah.
But generally speaking, there are some rules like that that would make for a cleaner, more visible presentation.
Mm-hmm.
If the shoulders aren't there, you know, how many guys have we seen do card manipulation and they're really doing it for themselves, and half the audience is getting a nice view of their shoulder and the dandruff in the back of their head.
Right. You need to keep your shoulders squared towards the audience. Basically, is what you're saying.
Yeah. And some of that is common sense, and if you see someone do it, you get it. But sometimes you need someone to teach some of those things to you.
You mentioned about the audience. I've got a real interesting question about audiences. When we're performing, sometimes we're working for a company and everybody knows each other.
Yeah.
Or if you're working like in a cruise ship, and there may be people who are just maybe families, or there could be just couples, or they've gotten to know the others. Which do you think is the easier or the more difficult audience, and why?
If
they're more homogeneic, in other words, they all know each other, do they feel...
If they all know each other and they don't know you, that's a real problem.
Okay.
Or it could become a real problem because they're more interested in Uncle Joe's reaction or the company's president's reaction or the girl they're trying to pick up.
Like it or not,
It's like having a real celebrity in the audience. I've had shows where Cary Grant is in the audience. You cannot get the audience focused because everyone's saying, what does Cary Grant think of this?
Yeah.
That's a tough audience.
That's interesting.
A strong performer can overcome that. Can you overcome it in 9 minutes?
Mm.
Maybe not. Can you overcome it in 15 minutes? Better chance. Half an hour? Now, if you know some of the audience and you can break them down so that they're no longer cohesive and you're on the other side, in other words, so
you
that...
You broke the fourth wall. Then.
Yeah, you've broken the wall and the barrier, you can get them.
Okay.
But, you know, you need to work on those techniques and... You know, everyone has had that experience where you can't get their attention.
And don't you think some of those techniques are exactly what you're talking about as far as square to the audience? Because if you turn from the audience, it's almost as if you're turning your back to the audience.
Yeah.
And subliminally, they may be thinking, well, he doesn't care about me.
Yes.
He cares about himself. But so I think it's important to smile to the audience. You know, some people have characters in which they're trying to be very serious or something. And I think, to me, that kind of turns off an audience, you know. But it may be their character.
The number of people who can really get away with that are the Channing Pollocks of the world. People who are either so iconic in their appearance or a character that's so strongly drawn that you immediately know who they are. But for the most of us, people are interested in other people more than they are in things.
Yes.
So when you have an interpersonal relationship, that's stronger than an object. So if you're given a choice between looking at a thing or looking at a person, people will look at a person.
That's right.
Now, once you have their attention, you can direct it towards that thing.
That's a very good point. That's right. But people are going to look where you're going to be looking.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So establishing a relationship with the audience is paramount.
Right.
And you want to do it as soon as you can so that you have the most time to take them on the journey you want to take them.
Mm-hmm.
If you have to take half your act to get to that point, you've lost a lot of momentum,
right.
Potential momentum.
Well, that was one of the things that impressed me about Lance Burton when I first saw Lance working years ago, like on Johnny Carson, you'd watch his FISM winning act, is the fact that he was not looking at his hands, but he was engaged with the audience, and he had a serious look. I mean, he wasn't smiling, but nor were his eyes smiling, or he wasn't like surprised like Doug Henning was, or who, or whatever. So it was a different style, but my whole point is that things just happened at his fingertips, much like Cardini, I guess, in which that they didn't surprise him. It's kind of like that's supposed to happen. He'd be having fans of cards, or here's the dove, and he was never looking at his hands, his jacket, his steels. He knew exactly where everything was, and his focus was on the audience as he was looking at them. Nor was it like, hey, look what I can do. It was completely different.
In an interview that Lance did with a Magic magazine, I don't remember which one, it'll come back to me. I think it was called The Conjurer. He later said in that interview that he thought that was a mistake on his part, not to look at the object more frequently than he had been.
Okay.
But having seen him and worked with him many, many times with that act the way it was, it exuded a confidence. When you don't have to look at what you're doing and you can totally focus on the audience, it exudes a power.
Mm-hmm.
It's a way of telling the audience, I'm so confident of what I'm doing. I have so much command of this material that I don't need to look and do it. And that's a win. You have to balance, each one has to balance for themselves how well that's going to work for them. For Lance, it worked fabulously well.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know that even with the command of his skills, it might work as well for another performer.
Mm-hmm.
However, in his case, it's clearly indicated this is a man who's a master of his material.
Absolutely.
He's spent so many hours, he doesn't even need to look at it.
Correct.
You know, that's a confidence, and people are enraptured by confident people.
Sure. Because, that's a very good observation.
Yeah. All of us are, in an inner person, lacking in confidence somewhere. No matter what we present to the outside world, we lack confidence, or we believe we do. So when you see someone who is that comfortable and that assertive, it becomes very seductive. You know, it's that James Bond quality. You know, he doesn't need to look. He knows.
Right.
You know.
Yeah. Yeah, there is that confidence, I guess.
Yeah.
But, boy, you know, how do you get that confidence except just through flight time?
That's it. When Lance used to work, this is when I used to be, we'd work at a strip club in Hollywood called The Body Shop.
I remember The Body Shop, sure enough. You were there working with him?
Oh, yeah.
I got a story about that, too, but sure, I remember that.
I've got a lot, but I don't know if they're suitable for publication. One-on-one, they're very funny stories. But Lance would come to the club. He'd do an 8 o'clock show. I'd do the 9 o'clock show. He'd do the 10. You know, we alternated.
Yeah.
So they had two magicians working for a period of time. Anyway, afterwards, Lance would go home and rehearse for 3 more hours. The same act he'd just done twice in the theater.
You know, whenever that he had won the gold medal here in Louisville, however many years ago, like it would have been like 79, something like that-ish. He, from what I understand, had gone into the theater for like 2 hours beforehand and just threw doves up at the spotlights and was, you know, trying to make sure they were trained, they knew the light, they would come back and land behind him, because they did. I mean, he was spot on.
Yeah.
But it was the dedication and time he put into it, what you're just talking about there.
You know, every afternoon at 3 o'clock, Cardini, would, no matter what he was doing, would stop and say, I have to go back to the room and he'd rehearse. Every afternoon of his life.
Regardless of whatever, he'd look at his watch. And
he'd be at a magic convention, go, oh, sorry, guys, I got to go. 3 o'clock, he's going to go rehearse. Even if it was working that night or not working.
Right.
Same time every day.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, that's interesting. I hadn't heard that story before. Yep. You know, not many people have that kind of
commitment to
practice in particular.
Yeah.
I think once they got it, it's okay to move on to something else.
Yeah.
And that's part of the thing why people don't have acts. They're kind of looking for that holy grail.
Yeah.
That's why we're here in the dealer's room. Everybody's looking for the next best thing.
They are looking for something that probably they already own.
That's right.
You know.
Well, what you own is your character that you can't be, can't take that away from you.
Yeah.
You know.
You need to learn to exploit it and make the most of it.
How did you find yours?
I don't know that I have, but I've found a reasonable substitute.
Mm-hmm.
Mine is the typical story. I certainly wasn't the most confident person in the world. However, I had an ideal in my mind of what I wanted to do, and I worked towards that ideal.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't really look at myself too carefully because I wasn't too pleased with what I'd see.
Okay.
But in my mind, I had an ideal of what I wanted to do with magic, and I was rigorous in my pursuit of that. And the style with which I now have, or personality, or my approach, is a reflection of that. What I'm really doing is doing the act that I wanted to see somebody else do in my formative years.
And nobody was doing.
And no one was doing.
Yeah.
It's what I interpreted magic to be. Now, certainly I had my heroes,
sure.
But I took a little bit from each one of them in a sense and said, that mixture is what I want to see, and I guess I've got to start working on it.
Yeah. And are you still polishing those edges?
Oh, I'm a long way from polishing. We're rough sanding still.
Really? You feel that you're so far away
from
the show? Really?
Oh, yeah. I'm never pleased with anything. You know, I can manage to get, say, it's acceptable or...
You still record your shows and go back and look at them, maybe?
Not as often as I could. It's very painful.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Because you're not hitting the notes or something?
No, I can hit the notes. It's just I can always find something I don't like, you know.
And it's just a move, a nuance, or a glance or
something? A glance. I think, oh, that looks sloppy. Well, I'm overselling this. That's too exuberant. Oh, I didn't wait long enough on that. You know, it's a million things.
But that's like really hard on yourself.
Yeah, but that's the love and the challenge of magic, because if we did it perfectly every show, would be Lance Burton. No, we might get bored.
Mm-hmm.
You know, every audience is different. So even if you do what you do technically perfectly, you still need to convey it to that audience, and they are not the same audience as last night.
Right.
They probably share 60, 70, 80% of similar characteristics, but there's always something else.
Mm-hmm.
The greatest entertainers who ever lived never settled. You know, I'm thinking now of Sammy Davis at his peak.
Okay.
Never stopped. He was constantly searching, what do I need to win this audience tonight? Not resting on 30 years of experience or whatever. What do I need to pull it out tonight and make it happen?
I can relate and I understand, because I saw Sammy Davis in performing in Las Vegas, and I remember that people were saying, do Bojangles, you know?
Yeah.
And he said, no, man, and he's talking with the audience. He said, I'm just not feeling it tonight. You know, he said, if I do it, he said, it's an emotional thing for me, and he said, I'll do it if I feel like it, and I just don't feel that tonight. And so he was being genuine with the audience.
Yeah.
I thought, man, it's like you're at a cabaret, but there were like 1,000 people there, you know?
Yeah, the audience was his living room.
Yeah.
Because he grew up on stage.
Mm-hmm.
So for him, there was no barrier, there was no wall. The wall was down, he was now in his living room.
Yeah, and every show, huh?
Every show,
yeah.
And the audience could feel that.
Yeah.
Here's a man who knows his craft, and it may not be the same tonight as it was last night, but he's doing it for us.
So you're learning from people, not just magicians, as you were talking about some of the mentors. You're drawing from all other kinds of entertainment.
Yeah, my real heroes were, you know, the Sammy Davises and the Fred Astaires and those guys who transcended their craft.
Yeah.
You know, in Sammy Davis's book called Yes, I Can, his first autobiography, Charlie Miller had written in his column in Magic Magazine, Genie Magazine, every magician should read this book. So I read it at the tender age of 10 or 11, hoping there'd be a lesson in here for me about magic, because Charlie Miller recommended this book.
Right.
And there were a lot of lessons in there. And when you think about Sammy Davis's career, he started out what was called a flash tap dance act. It was 8 minutes, to music, without talking.
Mm-hmm.
Sound familiar?
Yeah.
And one by one, he found ways to expand that talent to include something else. Do impressions. Now that I can do impressions, I can tell jokes. Now that I can do impressions, I'll do impressions of singers. Once they accept me as doing impressions of singers, I'll sing. Then I'll start singing as Sammy Davis. And so he very calculatedly, over the course of his career, took what is in essence the equivalent of a silent magic act. 8 minutes of Chavez, if you will. And learned how to open it up until he was regarded by many as the consummate entertainer or the greatest entertainer who ever lived, or Mr. Show, whatever you want to call him. Now, even if you don't like Sammy's style, I have to admire his thinking, making incremental steps to expand what he was. And Lance did that with his act. 12 minutes of manipulation, now he's going to talk. back to a music piece, into an illusion.
I wonder how long that he had studied and worked on that act. I know he'd worked like at a theme park for a number of years, and then he probably did a little bits of this and everything, you know. But I can't see doing like a dove act outdoors like that, you know, time after time at a theme park. But, you know, maybe he did.
I think he did.
Yeah.
And then he moved to Los Angeles with the act that he won at the IBM.
Yeah. How long did you guys work at the body shop?
He had a year contract. I didn't. The owner of that club usually had acts in for 2 weeks at a time. So I would be there for 2 weeks, and then someone else might be there for a week, or, you know, sometimes it was just Lance.
You think that's because he was such a hit on the Johnny Carson show?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the owner of that club ran it as a strip club, but he really wanted to run it as the Crazy Horse in Paris.
Yeah.
He thought of it as an elegant cabaret.
Mm-hmm.
It was never an elegant cabaret. But he had some good magicians through those doors. Norm Nielsen, Shimada, Pendragons, Lance Burton, Joseph Gabriel.
Wow.
You know, all there.
Yeah.
Many nights, there was a better show there than the Magic Castle, with all due respect to the Magic Castle. So it was a training ground for a lot of L.A.-based performers.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's a tough audience.
Well, because bring on the girls.
Yeah, yeah, bring on the girls.
Yeah.
And, you know, you learn, and you got tougher, you got stronger. Well, you didn't come back.
I was just I was talking with Orson Bean just recently, and I've got a podcast coming up with him, and he was talking about the same thing, trying to do comedy, you know, and somebody's trips. So he said, "You stink. Bring on the girls."
Yeah.
You probably got a lot of that.
Baptism by fire.
Yeah, yeah. But you're going to continue to
tough it out? You tough it out.
Yeah.
The magician had a bit of an advantage. Because he had some very good magicians there.
Yeah.
So I think the clientele there got to thinking, hey, if they like you in the first minute, they'll endure the next couple, and then they loved you towards the end.
Now, what are the kind of entertainers that they have? I mean, do they have singers?
No, he had on a weekend, he'd have a girl singer / stripper.
Mm-hmm.
He had a juggler in there for a while with a magician. He had not too many variety acts, because he was a member of the castle and he loved magic, the owner. And his name was Jamal Rofet. But he had a lot of magicians.
Yeah.
You know, and if I wasn't working it, I'd go in and see who was.
It's just a fun place to go and watch some of the people, see who's hanging out and who's performing in that week. How many shows a night? 4 or 5 shows a night?
Two for the magician. You know, well, I think we did 3 for a little while, but it was really 2.
Okay.
And if he wanted more, he'd bring in a second act, so Lance and I would alternate.
Yeah. My story isn't nearly as interesting as what yours is, I'm sure, but I was at the Magic Castle, and afterwards I went over there around midnight, and had a rental car, so I pulled over, and the lot was full, and so I pulled over like on the side of the street or something, and a guy walked out, and he said, well, you know, you're going to have to pay to park there, and I said, well, what do you mean? He said, well, it's like not valet parking, but you have to pay to park, and I said, well, how do I know that, you know, you're actually working here? He said, well, trust me. And I said, well, why should I trust you at midnight? I don't know you. You're just some guy. You don't have an orange jacket or anything, you know. I mean, he could have, you know, I was very bold. He could have robbed me, you know. And he said, hey, man, you can stay there if you want, but your car is probably going to be towed if you don't pay me.
Yeah.
So I thought, well, heck with it. So I got in the car and left, so I never did get to see Lance.
Oh.
I don't know. Do you know? Was that, I mean, did they charge for parking?
I don't think they did.
Not? Okay, that guy was screwing me then.
They had a lot that anyone could park in if you got there early enough.
Yeah, right behind the place,
I used to run there. I used to jog there, you know, so I didn't drive.
Oh, you weren't very far from there.
No, okay. I lived 2 miles away.
Okay,
You know, I would jog there and do my shows and jog home.
I know, guys, I got messed up once time with some guys on some drayage charges whenever I was working a ship, and that I had just gotten out of the taxi, and then you had to hand it to these guys, and then they put it on the ship, and then the ship people take it from there, and then they expect a tip. Well, my thing broke open, and I was putting their thing back, and they saw I was a magician. They said, well, it's going to cost you $50. I said, for what? I said, I was going to tip him anyhow. I said, well, it's $50. And I talked with the head porter, and he said, what did he tell you? He said, 50. So we'll pay him. He said, you know, otherwise, I figured that's not going to make it on the ship. I got robbed before he even got on the ship.
I work a lot of cruises, and I never let anyone handle my luggage.
That's good advice.
You know,
you probably don't have a lot that you hang.
I travel pretty light, but I've got two.
I used to bring a bowling ball. Don't anymore, but that old thing, yeah.
My last line would be to them if they say, well, no, we have to do it. I say, I'm on the show tonight, and I need to take it to the theater right now. Are you going to have it in there at 3 o'clock? Because I have a rehearsal.
Rehearsal, yeah.
And they knew they couldn't get it, guarantee it would be on the ship.
That's good. Good tip.
Whatever it took.
Yeah.
You know.
But again, that you don't have, I mean, you got a rope and some gypsy thread and a few other things, you know.
But I carry 2 45-minute shows.
Wow. Okay.
Like, because on most ships I do 2 different evenings.
Yep.
So that's two evenings. And then there's a second trunk. They're not huge cases. One's 50 pounds, the other's 45 pounds.
Yeah.
I can carry them both myself.
Right.
You know,
right.
They're conventional luggage.
How many weeks a year would you say that you work on ships?
In the past decade, probably 20 to 30.
Okay.
And it's not one ship. I'm jumping
yep.
from Rome to Sydney, Australia, back to the United States, down to South, you know, I'm a freelance kind of jumping, not one company.
Mm-hmm.
But now I've cut back a bit. And I'm trying to do more things in the magic world, so I don't have to travel.
Well, like
so
the lecture
far.
You're talking about, yeah.
Yeah, like that lecture,
whatever.
And I want to work
all
on
the
some
conventions
things.
And things yeah. like this. Yeah,
I haven't been at a magic convention since 2005.
Wow, it's been
so
a while back.
Probably to most of these people, I'm a new guy.
Yeah,
you know, oh, look at that new guy.
Well, but I think some of the older guys are going to say, "Wasn't he a mumbo jumbo? It's magic or something."
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Tom Bosley or something.
I saw that guy back at the.
Yeah, I got him on videotape from
yeah.
the 70s.
It was a kinescope. It was so far back. It was black and white.
But you held your age. I think there's somewhere there's a painting.
No.
Dorian Gray.
No. When I see that. Gene Anderson sent me a picture.
Yeah.
I had done a show with him about 30 years ago. He had a picture on his wall, and it was an old 8x10.
Yeah.
And I went, oh, I shuddered a bit when he showed me how young I was. I wrote back and said, whoever that imposter was, he's wet behind the ears.
Yeah.
Don't book him again.
That's funny. Well, before I close, let me ask you, the name of my podcast is called The Magic Word.
Absolutely.
So what would be your magic word? What is your phrase? What's your philosophy of life? What do you live by? What's important?
I have so many that are different for different purposes.
And it may change from day to day.
It does change from day to day. One of the ones I like is precision.
I like that?
Yeah. Precision.
I like it.
Yeah.
And so, for
right.
The Magic Word Podcast, that was Jonathan Neil Brown, and his word is precision.
That's it. Thanks.
Scotty,
thanks so much, Scott.
You bet. All right, well, one of the people who happens to be at the combined convention is a friend of mine for many years and is not actually on the bill and not someone who is having to give a talk, and you kind of got to relax a little bit then this year and not do anything, and that's David Bull. David, hello.
Hi, Scott. Great to be with you.
And my pleasure to be with you. And for those of you who are listening and thinking, David Bull, that sounds kind of familiar. Well, you know the first name, but maybe not the last name. Maybe you know it as LeGrand David. And David would be the, I guess, the Spanish pronunciation. Is that correct?
Spanish, French, yes.
Whatever. Is that what in French also is David?
Well, LeGrand David was like the French spelling, you know.
Okay.
Yes.
The French spelling. And so how did that come about? I mean, how did Cesario actually...
Well, one of the backstories of that is when I joined the larger theatrical group...
And cheers, by the way, to you, sir.
Thank you. the larger theatrical ensemble that Cesario was putting together, there was another David mm-hmm. who was older than me.
So in the troops.
So to differentiate between us, Cesario would call him Le Grand David, and I was Le Petit David.
Okay.
So when, you know, the roles were chosen and I became the magician, and we always talked about three generations of magic. Cesario would represent the older generation as Marco the Magi. I became Le Grand David at that point. And then there was Seth, who
right.
was 4 years old in the first show in 77. And now is like in his 40s.
And didn't you say, or maybe Rick was telling me, he's in finance or something now, or international?
Computers. Big computer company that he got in on the ground floor right after college and made a killing.
Good
yeah.
for him.
Yeah.
Good for him. And so, anyhow, that started in 77. It was the first year. Now, getting all those people together. I hate to compare this with Jesus, you know, bringing together his disciples from different places, but in a way, you know, it was someone who had great charisma and was bringing together people in a place you wouldn't expect. I mean, in Beverly, Massachusetts, of all places, as opposed to New York City or Chicago or,
right.
you know, some larger place.
Right.
How did he come about finding each of the people?
Well, he was at Brandeis,
so well
he was Brandeis University in the 60s with Abraham Maslow.
Yeah.
And met some students and graduate students there who followed him to his center up in New Hampshire called Cumbres, which was kind of a mini Esalen Institute that was going on the West Coast. It had to do with human development and all these ideas, many of which came from Maslow about self-actualization and higher being values and all this sort of thing. So when I first met Cesario when I was 18 years old and my older brother brought him home to our family's Easter dinner, I knew him as this psychologist.
Right.
I had no idea he was into theater and whatnot, but he went on to teach at Salem State College, and from all of these stages, he collected people, friends, colleagues, students.
And he kept them as friends.
Absolutely, yeah. And organized them. There were at least a couple of houses where he said to, you know, six college students, get together and rent a house and
like
live together and become friends, basically.
Like a fraternity house, because it was a fraternal
exactly.
group, basically.
Yeah,
or very
just a lot more sane than most fraternities.
Yeah. They had a real goal.
And then in around, it was 76 when we actually bought the first theater, the Cabot Street Cinema Theater in Beverly. Mm-hmm. And there was...
you weren't in Beverly. That's not where the where you guys were congregating. It was...
Well, some people were living in Beverly. Some were in Salem. Some were in Boston.
Okay.
All over. But
and was he looking for a place? Or how did the Cabot Street Theater come about?
Well, he was looking for a theater.
Yeah.
And he looked downtown Boston, and it was... You know, many of the ones that were available were right next to what was then called the Combat Zone, where the strip joints were
okay,
and
sure.
X-rated movie houses.
Yeah.
So we looked at the suburbs, and there was an old E.M. Lowe theater in Beverly that was kind of run down, and E.M. Lowe was in financial trouble at that point, and he said, "Well, I'll sell it to these kids." You know, because I was, 21, 22 at the time. Cesario is probably the oldest of the group, and that's how we walked in there in the August of the bicentennial summer of 76, started running movies, renovating the theater, and put our first show on the next February.
So you were taking the money or the profits, I guess, from the movies that you were running in order to start buying the props and the paint and everything?
Absolutely.
And
so start getting money to come in.
Right.
Because bills happen from day one.
So he had obviously a long-term vision.
He did. I wasn't privy to it. And when he
just said, okay, whatever.
I was there for the adventure. I just didn't. Yeah. I didn't know. And I had transferred. I'd actually started college in Switzerland.
Really?
And come back.
Studying what?
Studying the good life in Europe.
Okay, fair enough.
And I came back in the summer to visit my brother Webster, and was reunited with Cesario, who I'd met several years before, and met all these people that were sort of loosely or closely associated in his orbit, and decided to transfer to BU, Boston University, because there was this talk of some theater adventure, and it was very nebulous and unclear. But it's one of those times in your life when you have a gut-level hunch.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know what this is, but this sounds interesting. I'm going to stick around.
Yeah.
So instead of going back to Switzerland, I transferred to BU, just in order to be around for this,
right,
whatever it was going to be.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, now, I know that what Cesario was good at doing was to identify what people were good at. Like he would say to Rick, you're going to paint, or to somebody else, you're going to be the seamstress, or you're going to build back props. How did he come to you, and what was it about you being the magician?
I think he knew I was an athlete my whole life, so there was the physical training, the discipline. He knew I was interested in theater, you know, in school productions, and I had gone into Broadway because we lived in Fairfield County, Connecticut. My mother would take us in and, you know, some great plays like James Earl Jones of The Great White Hope, you know, and this sort of thing.
Yeah.
So I think he saw promise in me that I didn't even recognize in myself at that age.
And that was what he was particularly good at, is seeing things that other people didn't see.
Evaluating personalities, talents, and how not only individual talents, but how certain people can work together. You know, in the first barbershop quartet, you know, he chose the four individuals to get together.
Yeah.
And
their voices did just happen to blend perfectly, too. Yeah.
Yeah. And then it became 8 and 12 and then 16 in the chorus, barbershop chorus. And same with the women and the tap dancing and sewing. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was an incredible team of women that got together and became really good seamstresses, sewing costumes, curtains.
Right.
Props, everything.
Have you ever met anybody like him before or after?
And I don't expect I ever will. I mean, he was one of these unique individuals, and part of it was his cultural background from Cuba. and his training, not only in psychology but in the law.
Oh, I which, thought about that.
Yeah. He said his mother wanted him to be a diplomat. And he went to Havana Law School for one semester until the riots broke out in advance of the revolution.
Yeah.
So he was an amazing individual and certainly one of the most intelligent people I ever met in my life.
Now, the fellow you said that was the other David, that was the older one, what did he end up doing? LeGrand David? You were Lapide?
He became the head clown.
Oh, is that right? That was Bosco or Besco?
No. Well, there was Besco. That was someone else on stage.
Okay.
But there was like a clown chorus, clown band.
Yeah.
And this guy became Tassels the Clown.
Okay.
And was around for many years with his wife. And then they had a daughter who was in the show for a while.
Did you have a lot of people who came and went or perhaps that would like to have stayed but didn't or...
All of the above.
Okay.
And some people stayed for a year, some for 2, 5, 10 years. We had a photographer who came from the Salem Evening News to do a story on us in the early 80s and stayed for 5 years.
Wow.
You know, like running away with a circus.
Right.
But the circus was in residence in town.
Well, as I said, that Estrella was really good at being able to identify certain traits that people would have. Did he ever take a look at someone after a while and say, you know, you're not working out, you're going to have to leave?
Actually, yes. That happened, and also there were a couple of examples I remember, people coming and staying and then going to Cesario and saying, Cesario, I just don't belong here. Even one guy who unfortunately ended up in jail, but he actually said to Cesario, you people you're too good for me.
Wow.
Yeah, it was really quite a moment, and he left. We found out he ended up in jail, and so every kind of example, because dozens of people passed through the company.
How many people would you say was part of the core organization, about 20, 24? Or?
Yes, and then there were maybe another 40 people loosely associated that would show up on the weekends, do the rehearsals, do the shows, and then go off and have a job, you know, Monday through Friday.
Right. And I know that the people who did it loved what they were doing, and as I said, because that... Once they were identified, they could find that thing that they were best at. They continue to do that and were really good at it. So I can see why that they would stay. And the pictures that I've seen, like that Rick would show where everybody's painting the backdrops, and he was saying, I don't paint these. He said, I might create them. And I say, okay, let's do this. But really, it is all teamwork from the standpoint that it's a team painting. It's not a Rick painting, you know.
That's right, and that's something Cesario stressed over and over again. You know, no matter how brilliant he was or creative, he needed a team around him. He could never have done it by himself.
Right.
And so it was a great feeling to work together, you know, and this was my people who became my best friends. I had my brother, the woman who became his wife, and then later on, their two daughters grew up on stage, and that was probably my happiest role, Uncle David. That was even better than the LeGrand David.
Was there a particular illusion or part of the act that you did, or maybe that you saw Cesario, someone else do, that was one of your favorite bits?
Probably my favorite thing, which closed the Larkham show, which is the second show we developed after we bought the Larkham in 84, was the Dakota chair, where I would sit in the chair, Cesario would cover me with a cloth, then he'd show me under the cloth. It seemed immediately a tip-over trunk rolled on from the side with Rick and Avram as in their clown characters. They tip it forward, show it empty, tip it back, close the lid. Cesario would whisk away the cloth off the chair. I'm gone, and I'm in the trunk.
Just like that.
And it was just, I remember seeing Ricciardi do this effect in the Village Gate in New York City. We all caravan down there to see it, and I could swear that I saw his daughter in the chair when the box was on stage, when you try to recreate it in your mind.
Sure. Yeah.
So this was impossible.
It really fooled you.
And it so fooled me, and it was such a strong effect that was the last, we brought the curtain down, that was it.
Wow. And so I know that all the illusions, the props, and of course the building and everything was all sold off. So there's really, was there anything that you had kept or something that was a memory that you said, I want to keep this?
Well, one prop that I did keep, it's at home with me, is the Robert Harbin upside down production box, which Cesario said, why don't you look at the plan, see what you can do with this? And often his suggestions were that casual, offhand, you know, and people either picked up the ball and ran with it or didn't. But at, it took me about 6 months of part-time puttering to put this thing together, and it was always in the Larkham show. And then last fall at the Yankee Gatherings Collectors Convention, I gave a talk on the upside-down production box and then showed a clip at the end of the talk of us doing it on stage at the Larkham.
And it was Harbin's original design?
Yes, it was one of his original creations.
Now, I remember talking with Cesario some time ago about a couple of ideas that I thought someone else had created, and he said, well, actually, we've been doing that earlier. So there were a lot of things that are not credited to the show that I think were original with you guys.
Well, I know some examples. I won't name names or, you know, but yes. And but, you know, that's part of the creative process.
Well, I think it's great the fact that, you know, you don't take credit for that. In other words, kind of like, okay, well, we know. We don't care that everybody else, and we're not going to get into a big argument about this.
Well, I think the most important thing was not necessarily the specific tricks, was the style that Cesario brought, the grand theatricality of it.
Yeah.
You know, it's not the guy in front of the front curtain or, you know, I mean, there was such elaborate scenery, hundreds of costumes.
It was so much like Camelot. I mean, I can't imagine that something like this could ever happen again. I mean, this was a particular point in time and a person and a troupe that was put together of a family that believed in a goal, and then just like, you know, it just disappeared, you know.
Well, it was very interesting.
Brigadoon, that's what I'm trying to say. Brigadoon, the next day it's gone.
And
you know?
Brigadoon lasted for 35 years in our case.
Yeah.
And we celebrated the anniversary in February 2012. 4 weeks later, on Houdini's birthday, no less, Cesario dies.
It's amazing, isn't it?
But we finished out the season, did our last show, I think May 26th or 27th, 2012, Memorial Day weekend. And we just said, you know what? We did it.
Yeah.
And we were all in our 20s when we began, and now people had grandkids.
Right.
People were scheduling their hip replacement surgeries or wanted to spend the winter in Florida.
Right.
So, it was a different time of life.
Of course.
And, you know, we felt we did it.
Yeah.
You know, and I have no regrets.
You did. I mean, you were the top of the game from start to finish and had done it all, gotten all of the awards, certainly, and all the publicity from every major magazine and Time magazine and everything else, you know, at the time.
Right.
Used to go to Easter egg roll, I guess, all the time also. You went to the White House how many times?
We went to the White House 7 times, I think 6 times for the Easter egg roll, and then 1 time at Christmas in the White House with Nancy Reagan hosting.
That had to be fabulous.
It was. You know, Willard Scott as Santa Claus, and Mr. Rogers was there, and Nancy Reagan hosting. And, of course, the White House decorated to Christmas is just spectacular.
I can only imagine. Yeah, that must have been a beautiful time. So, yeah, as I said, I can't imagine that something else like this happening, but do you think that this could be recreated again by anybody?
Is it possible? Cesario said, never say never.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's possible. I mean, we did it.
Yeah.
But it takes a very special set of conditions, I think. And when people ask me, you know, what do we need to do what you did, I said, you need a Cesario.
Yeah, find him and then you can go from there.
Yes.
Well, speaking of that then, of course, you have so much advice that you've received from him over the years. What one piece of advice would you say that he has given that you could pass on to others? That is a heavy question there.
He used to have a statement about the attitude you bring to the show. Mm-hmm. He said, make an appointment with your best self.
Yeah.
3 o'clock, Sunday afternoon, curtain goes up, make an appointment with your best self. leave your soap opera, leave your problems at the door, wipe your feet well, come in and give the best you have in you. And so you had a group of individuals that most of the time were able to do that, and then it's the working together. It's the ensemble that he stressed over and over again. It's not just you, it's you're working with other people.
Right.
And how well can we coordinate and flow together?
Well, I could ask what everyone else is doing, and I know they've gone to the winds, it seems like. So since I'm with you, what are you doing?
Well, a year after we closed the show, I met a woman who I'm now engaged to, and we bought a home out in Western Massachusetts. So I'm out in the Connecticut River Valley, and we've sold the theaters, we've auctioned everything off. I'm looking for work as an actor and toying with the idea of creating a new character to do a performing character that would incorporate magic and hopefully a lot of comedy, a lot of laughs, but not Le Grand David, something else.
As part of your past life,
Yeah, I say to people, I'm on to chapter three.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. As I close, the name of my podcast is called The Magic Word, so I always like to ask my guests, what is your magic word then, David, or you know, your philosophy? It could be something, again, that you had learned from Cesario or something that you've just developed over time and where you are at this point in your life. What's your philosophy?
Well, Rick Heath, who was our great poster artist all those years, gave a wonderful talk here at the Combined Convention. I think it was, the Life Membership meeting.
Yeah.
And he talked about Cesario's emphasis on togetherness, that it's everything happens in relationship. You know, none of us are islands unto ourselves, even though we often think of that we are. But so that is the great issue of my life moving forward, and I think, you know, in society at large, how do we work and live together without destroying, you know, what we've built?
Yeah, togetherness. That's good. Perfect. Well, thank you very much, David. It's always a pleasure to see you, my friend. Thank you very much for being on the Magic Word Podcast. So, from Louisville, Kentucky, here at the Magic Word Podcast, that was David Bull, and this is Scotty out.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that. That was some fun. We had a couple of guys here that time. We got to enjoy both Jonathan Neal, or he as he used to be known, Jonathan Neal Brown. I guess that's the way that I first had met him many years ago, back working at the Magic Island back in the 80s, I guess, had changed his name, truncated that just to Jonathan Neal. I guess kind of like John Cougar Mellencamp. Didn't he just change it to John Mellencamp or John Cougar? Anyhow, kind of drop one of his names. And then also with David Bull. And he, of course, was Le Grand David. I thought it was interesting that he was known as Le Petit David for a while there, that Cesario had called him that when there were two Davids in the show. Well, anyhow, there's a twofer for you, and it is kind of rare wherever I combined a couple like this, but it just so happened that the conversations ran a little bit longer than I had anticipated and also a little bit shorter than I had anticipated. Sometimes that when I'm running around the conventions, I like to just get a few snippets of about 8 minutes maybe or to 10 minutes of different people's conversation. And in this case, that they went a little bit longer than I thought you would enjoy hearing a different perspective from both Jonathan Neal and from David Bull. And so there you have it. So this week, speaking of twofers, I've got another twofer for you. I've got two product reviews, and from two different companies. One from Magic Inc. in Chicago, and the other from Murphy's Magic Supplies. First up, I want to talk about the Oxbender by Manny Lindenfield. This actually is a gimmick, or a prop, which is disguised so that your audience can't see it. Let me describe the effect, first of all. You borrow a coin, whatever denomination or currency, it could be a foreign currency, and you have the spectator then sign it. You hand them a Sharpie. They put their name or a picture or whatever they want on it. They return the coin, and you recap the pin, and you then hand the coin to them. You show them, you're going to want you to hold your hand out like this and clench your fist, and then you hand them the coin. And then when they clench their fist, as you had just shown them, you go through the presentation and the coin is bent. Their signed coin, which they keep as a souvenir, obviously. And it can't be unbent unless, I guess, you go back out and go through a vise or whatever. But, it is really bent. And the gimmick or the prop you get is quite well made and should last a lifetime if you follow the instructions. It's about a one-hour instructional video that's available online that you can watch that shows you a couple of presentations that you can do not only with a coin, but also with twisting the neck of silverware, as well as keys, breaking keys and bending keys. I've never been a big proponent of keys because if anybody carries keys with them, they're always something that they need to open the house, you know, start the car or whatever. I mean, people don't carry around extra keys that aren't used for anything. So I hate to ever borrow someone else's key and use that. And of course, if you have your own key, I always feel as if that it would be a gimmick key or something. So anyhow, whereas if you're using a coin or a spoon in a restaurant, that it is more organic and, of course, more impromptu. And so this is something that can be impromptu as long as you carry this gimmick with you. I'll also say that the thing that you're carrying really can't be seen very well. I believe that the handling of this Manny teaches you is excellent, because this way you know that it's not going to be seen. It is something that will take a little bit of strength. Let me just tell you that. He suggests that you use one of these squeeze things, you know, that increases your hand strength. You know, what am I trying to say? Just, so it's like a spring thing that you squeeze to each day, so this way that you continue to increase your strength. Because there are some coins that are easier to bend than others, and there are some that he says you should not try at all. For example, some euro coins that have some other kind of metal inside other metal, because if you do, then it could get stuck and you ruin the gimmick. But all those warnings aside, that the gimmick itself is well made. And again, he tells you some do's and don'ts as to handling of it. And if you follow it, follow instructions, should last you a lifetime, and also a lifetime of impromptu miracles. I think this is really a cool thing. Apparently, he had come up with this idea after being busted by using the Sharpie. Many of you are aware of the Sharpie bender, where there's a hinge in it and it's especially made Sharpie and whatever. And apparently that he was performing somewhere in a local restaurant or something, and they had security cameras. And they went back and looked at the security cameras and realized, hey, you know, that you bent it with a Sharpie somehow or another. Didn't know how it was or never seen anything like that, but they knew exactly what it was. So that's why I came up with this other idea that is undetectable from all angles, pretty much. I think if you're looking for something, perhaps you might find it, but the handling of this is natural, the look of it is organic, and the presentation, the performance is excellent. I really highly recommend this. If you're going to be doing something or carrying something with you that you want to do some improvisational miracles, this is the thing. Again, it's Oxbender by Manny Lindenfield, and it's available through Murphy's Magic Supplies and available at your favorite dealer. Next up is a book that was published by Magic Inc. As a matter of fact, I think it was one of their newest publications. I had recently given you a review of Al James' Conjurer at the Table, that is a master course in restaurant magic, with a foreword by Johnny Thompson. That was a very good book, which I recommended. It was a very fun read, a light read. Had some photos in there of some of the magicians from the past, and again, had tricks and history, and quite enjoyable, and just kind of a quick, fun read. This next one I'm going to be telling you about is the opposite of that, from the standpoint that, yeah, it's a fun read. I think that the guys who wrote this, I would like to meet sometime, because they just seem like great guys. I enjoy their writing style. Let me tell you, the name of the book is called A New Angle by Ryan Plunkett and Michael Feldman. And the book is about what we know as a stripper deck, but as they refer to it, really is a taper deck, which is really the correct way of trying to explain what this kind of a deck is. And you're all familiar with what a stripper deck is, or a taper deck, in which that it's basically kind of shaved. And they talk about different kinds of shavings, and they go into a lot of detail. Most people think, of course, that the stripper deck or the taper deck is something that magicians, most of us, get in a starter kit to begin with, and you do a couple of tricks, and then that's also something that most laymen are familiar with, because that's one of the first tricks they purchased and then never went on any further, and they, like the rest of us, probably threw it in their drawer and never did anything with it. Well, these two young gentlemen had gone out and taken this to another level and another level and yet another level. They just really tore it apart and started to figure out, what can we do that will really take this deck, which is a great instrument, and if you just kind of swap out a cold deck with a stripper deck or a taper deck, I think you could really do some miracles, because people won't be expecting it, particularly if you have a good deck that is not going to be too obviously shaved. You want to have something that's going to be much more narrowly shaved, something that is less detectable, but you know what you're doing, and also it has a lot to do with the handling. Now, I said this is the opposite of the other book, that is The Conjurer at the Table, from the standpoint that A New Angle is all about tricks. There's no history or anything in there, and also it's not really a light read, from the standpoint that you do need to take some cards in hand and to work your way through it. There are some that are much more difficult than others. I enjoyed Shuffleupagus and some of the other tricks that were in there. And it was it took a little bit of time for me to go through, and I didn't quite understand it. I had to go back through a second and yet a third time before that I was able to understand exactly. And so, okay, yeah, I must have missed this the first time around. And there are a few other things that are called shavings. They'll have a few short chapters that are called shavings that are basically some tips and some shorter tricks and some easier things to do. So there are things I would say, a beginner or someone new working with a taper deck, all the way through those who are wanting to spend more time and really try and fool the pants off of your spectator with some of the things. Now, there are some really great effects in here and good teachings. And also, there are black and white photographs, so it is quite clear as to how the tricks are done and what to look at. It's well detailed from that standpoint, well documented in the appendix and in the back, certainly, that they have everything cross-referenced. And one of the things I thought was interesting also was they were talking about a stay stack. Hadn't really heard of that before. Perhaps it's been around for a while, but it was new to me, a stay stack, in which that you have something that's kind of like a palindrome, kind of like the word civic, S-C-I-V-I-C, which is the same forwards as it is backwards. Of course, you would have cards that would be stacked in a certain way so that you would have, well, easily enough, let's say the, you know, ace of clubs, king of diamonds, king of hearts, ace of spades type of thing, you see, but it'd be a longer stack than that. Anyhow, ideas like with that and other kinds of things, triumph moves and some things perhaps that have been traditionally done by magicians but done in a completely different way with using a different gimmick deck and in a different way of handling the cards, certainly, that would certainly fool other magicians. And so if you're thinking about doing something, particularly, I guess, in a magic contest and wanting to fool magicians, you can find something in here probably that will win you an award at a magic contest. And for that matter, if you're thinking about America's Got Talent, or you're wanting to go on stage and do something and try to win an award, there are some ideas in here, I think, that you can really fool some people. Maybe even fool Penn and Teller. Who knows? So, anyhow, that is a interesting book. It is something that will take some time. Some of the things in there, you might get discouraged and think, okay, I'm going to go on to something else. So I would suggest that you kind of plow through it. You might come back, you kind of skim it and read some other things, come back to them, because I believe you'll find some real gems in there. Because there's some ideas not only by Ryan and Michael, but they have some of their friends who contributed to this then as well. It is, again, one of the newer books by Magic Inc., and as I understand it, one of their bestsellers. I think that they had nearly sold out, and by the time that this is being released, it's possible they may have less than 100 copies left even in stock of this printing. I suspect that because of its success that they might start printing some more, but in talking with Sandy Marshall and Pedro Nieves, that they said that this has been the fastest-selling book of any title that they've had. So there are a lot of people trying to get their hands on A New Angle, and perhaps you should too. It's, again, a recommended book with the caveat that it will require some real work. This is not just a book you read through. It's something that you take some cards in hand and work with. And I believe that you'll find some really good tricks in there that you might want to put into your repertoire as well. And so, again, that's A New Angle by Ryan Plunkett and Michael Feldman, available from Magic Inc.
And so with those twofers of both the two different gentlemen that we spoke to today, plus the two product reviews, I think it's time to wind down this week's podcast. Thank you guys again very much for listening. And I also want to thank the GreatAmericanMagicCompany.com for sponsoring this episode of the Magic Word Podcast. So until next week, stay well, get booked, and I'll give you two thoughts to remember as we close out the twofer, that is precision and togetherness. Think about those. This is Scotty out.